This is a presentation exploring whether the church should take a position on the Star Wars policy or not. Let me tell you my background a little bit to this. I chair the joint task force in Iowa for the LCA and the ALC, the two church bodies. Our task force is called the Task Force on Peace and Reconciliation. We began by dealing with the arms race more generally, and when Star Wars emerged on March the 23rd, 1983, as an official policy of the U.S. government, we were put in a dilemma in our task force about whether or not the church in Iowa should take an official stand in relation to this. So it's a thing that we have wrestled with in some depth. And I want to enlarge that conversation and give you something of our conclusion about it in our task force, and hear some response from you, the whole idea at Holden being that we explore things together. You will see very quickly that I have a definite opinion, and I will state that unapologetically, but I do it with the expectation that we will have conversation about it, and not because I got the word from Sinai on that all of a sudden. So, the topic now is Star Wars, should the church take a stand? There's no question that the church is for peace. I guess that's a truism. We can expect the church to make statements affirming that we support peace. We can take one step further than that. Almost all of the major denominations, Christian denominations in the United States and other religious bodies, have taken a stand against the escalation of the arms race. There seems to be quite general agreement about that among the established churches. But when the Star Wars proposal came out on March the 23rd in 1983, the question became, now when you come to a specific policy like this, should the church take an official position? It's a way of sharpening up an issue that comes up a lot of times. Well, the first point I want to make about this is that it seems the most important role that the church has in relation to public life is to contribute to the national understanding of the common good. That's a subject that's gotten a lot of attention in the last year. Almost all of you are familiar with or seen reviews of Robert Bellah's book called Habits of the Heart. He took that topic out of de Tocqueville's study on America in the 19th century. And his point is that we've come to this situation in our country where everything operates by self-interest. And everybody is concerned about how he or she's going to get the piece of pie that belongs to her or to him. And the conclusion of that book is you can't operate a country that way. You can't just have everybody scrambling for as much as she or he can get. You have to have some understanding of what the common good is, because that's the way you build a community or a country. And it's my conviction that the most important contribution that the church makes to this, to the idea of Star Wars, is to inform our country's understanding about our common good. Now, exactly what that is a matter for considerable debate and exploration. The Lutheran World Federation, the American branch of it, Lutheran World Ministries, is currently beginning a study called The Common Good. Richard Neuhaus's book is one of The Naked Public Square is one of the early explorations of that and will be one of the bases for the conversation by that study group. Richard Neuhaus's conclusion is that the public square has been left naked. That is the public square which symbolizes the common good or those virtues that we hold in common that we think need to be held up, that has been abandoned. And he believes that it needs to be filled. Now, of course, the Jerry Falwells and the people of the far right have their own notion about how that ought to be filled. So that's another component in this whole conversation about what is the nature of the common good. And while I have vigorous differences of opinion with Jerry Falwell, the basic idea that the Christian understanding and perception should inform our understanding in our country of what the common good is appropriate. Liberals have backed off from that a lot because liberals were afraid, believed in more the secularization of society. And we've come to that time in our history where Harvey Cox's secular city is a passé notion. That is, we recognize that secularization is not the solution to the world's problems, because it does end up in self-interest. And we have to seek again for a common good. Now, liberals have appropriately been wary of the notion that we are a nation that is God's own special people above all the other people of the world, that we have a manifest destiny to tell everybody in the world what to do and that sort of thing. They have appropriately backed off of that kind of common notion of what the common good is. But there's a danger of throwing the baby out with the bath, I believe, on that. And we have to recover again a national conversation of exploration so that we have some understanding about what the common good is and what our country represents and stands for. So that's the first important contribution that the church can make to Star Wars or any other political issue. The second important contribution that the church can make, and I think one for which we'd have little difference of opinion among ourselves, is that the church should provide a forum in which people can have an open exploration about the issues that are at hand. There are going to be differences of opinion among people in the church. And when an issue like Star Wars comes, the church ought to be a place where Christians can come and explore what it means to be faithful at this moment in history. Now, people who come for that conversation will come from different positions and different points of view. But the church is a place where we can have those honest differences of opinion. And as Elmer Witt says frequently about Holden, where we can have those differences of opinion and come together around the altar of our Lord in a common unity. That is, we can have unity with this diversity of opinion. Now, we have not always been very good about that. Somebody said in a conversation earlier this week that, what do we do about these social issues? You can have some kind of adult study program on that in the church, but nobody comes to it anyhow. I mean, they go to something else. You have that once in a while because you feel you ought to, and you put it in there even though you only have 7 people that gathered to discuss. There doesn't seem to be much interest in the church in coming together to explore earnestly those issues that are going to do the most to shape our future. Somewhere, the role of the church as a forum needs to be held up. Holden is a place, I believe, that can do that and can encourage us here so that we have new enthusiasm for going about, a new fullness of spirit as we go about doing it in our local congregations. There are other places in the church that do it. There are various institutes. The Lutheran Human Relations Association that Carl's connected with here has done a lot to promote that sort of conversation in the church. I would hope that our church colleges provide that kind of vigorous forum where give and take can happen. But there's one thing that worries me even beyond whether we can get enough people to come together for the conversation. It's worried me ever since I was a student in college. The thing that scared me most when I went to college, the thing that threatened my faith more than anything else, was not the evolution issue or the inspiration of Scripture, those things that got so much attention. You know what scared me more than anything? When I went to sociology class and I learned that people were more influenced by their class status than by their church affiliation. That's what scared me more. That is, our real convictions in life are shaped not by what we propound on Sunday morning in church. The real convictions of our lives are shaped by what class we belong to. That also shapes what church we go to, I guess, as well. So there's those questions are very important. And one of the big issues, we talked about inclusiveness in the Lutheran Church on Sunday night, or Monday night. One of the big issues in the church is whether the church really is a forum, or whether a church is a gathering together of middle-class people who are protecting our very comfortable place in society. That's a tough question. And we need people from the full spectrum of society. Not because we're going to be kind to those poor people who've got it tough, but because we cannot be faithful to our Lord's commission unless their perceptions are a part of the conversation of faithfulness. The church will not be a full forum on Star Wars or any other issue until we have a full spectrum of the classes of our society represented in that forum. A third way in which the church contributes to the conversation on issues is that the church does take an official position on some political issues. Now, the Lutheran Church has been reluctant to do this for a long time, but we've come to the point where we are generally agreed that there are some political issues where we need to take a position. And I think that the experience of the Lutheran Church in Germany, of the Nazi era, and of the Holocaust has made it impossible for any of us any longer to say that we can exempt ourselves from political issues. That is a mark, an indelible mark on our past, which we dare never forget. If the Lutheran Church in Germany had, as a body, stood up against the forces that brought about the Holocaust, it might not have happened. That's as serious as it is. And of course, there are those accusations from Scherer and others that Nazism could only have happened in a Lutheran country, where people learn to be submissive to authority. Those are hard words for us, and words that somehow have to be a part of our consciousness as we shape what it is to be faithful today. I don't think there is anybody today who does not admire Bonhoeffer for standing, and the Confessing Church generally, for standing up against the power of the Nazi regime. And that is also a part of our heritage, and that part of our heritage is what it seems to me important for us to remember now. Do some of you know Peter Stafford's play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead? It's a takeoff on Hamlet. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, as you may remember from Hamlet, are two minor characters. They are servants in the household of the king, and they are spies that the king assigns to watch Hamlet, and at one stage in the play actually to accompany him over to England with letters that he is to be executed as soon as he gets over there. Well, you know how Hamlet ends in Shakespeare's version, about how the whole royal household is in disarray, lying bloodied and dying on the floor. The king is dead. Gertrude, the queen, is dying, Hamlet is dead, and Laertes is dead. And Denmark falls into that worst of all fates. It is taken over by the Norwegians. And it's sort of at that point that that Peter Stoppard begins a play. Anyhow, during his version of this, now the 20th century version, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are going over to England. They are reflecting about this carnage that is left behind. All the household, the royal household, is dead. And they are remembering that they had some part in all of that. And as they are going there across the channel, Rosencrantz says to Guildenstern, "There must have been some time back there near the beginning when we could have said no." Now that certainly must be our sense of things about the Nazi era. There must have been some time back there near the beginning when the church could have said no. A similar position happens with apartheid. There is general agreement that it is a matter of confession that apartheid is evil and is to be opposed by the church. The Lutheran World Federation, as you know, has gone through that very painful process of finally declaring separation from the Lutheran churches in South Africa because they have not taken a vigorous stand opposed to apartheid, because they are involved, complicitous in the apartheid policies in South Africa. Well, that's a very difficult stand to take. But finally, the Lutheran Church said, it is not possible to confess the faith and to support apartheid. And if you do, you are not part of this fellowship. Now that is an official stand of the church on what is a political issue. And we would find it very hard to say, well, the church shouldn't take a stand on that. So we have general agreement, I think, that there are some times in life that the church needs to take a stand on political issues. I think everybody agrees with that. The tough question is, what are those times? Because on the other hand, I at least don't believe that the church ought to be running the country. Luther has a saying that is quoted at least by Roland Baton. I've never been able to find the source of it. If some of you can help me, I'd appreciate it. But Luther emphasized the importance of vocation, and that politicians were called to exercise their vocation as politicians, and that that was their Christian responsibility. And one of the things that Luther has said, according to Bainton, is that he would rather be governed by a wise Turk than by a well-meaning Christian. Now you have to understand that the Turks were threatening to destroy European civilization. I mean, it would be like the big bogeyman of communism that's held over the Western world these days. And it would be like, you know, I'd rather have a competent Stalin running the government than a well-meaning Christian. That was a pretty bold statement for Luther to be making at that time. But he was underlining the point that the church does not have the kind of competence that's required for making all those political decisions. Politics is the art of the possible. And if you're not willing to be involved in the kinds of compromises and things that are possible in politics, then your politics is not your vocation. So the role of the church is rather to be prophetic, to call into question those things that are demonic in the public life, and to call us to remember our ultimate allegiance. Now, I am going to conclude out of this that Star Wars may well be a position in which the church should take an official stand. And to stake that one out as my proposal. And it's a risky one because it's a very specific political decision. And let me give you some things that I think contributions a church can make to these kinds of decisions like Star Wars, and things that make me feel that this is part of our call to faithfulness, and that hopefully will provide a basis for discussion. First of all, I think it's the responsibility of the church to identify idolatry wherever it is found. That is not something that's on the periphery of the church, that is after it's taken care of its evangelism and its stewardship and all of its other ministries. If it got a little time left over, it should give attention to this subject. Identifying idolatry is at the heart of the proclamation of the church. One proclaims God's love, his care, the gospel for the world, and denounces that which perverts God's love in the world. Suppose, for example, that there were a country in which, well, I can't imagine this happening, in which consumerism or the drive for achieving wealth took precedence over everything else. The golden calf, in other words, reigned. Would it be the responsibility of the church to identify that idolatry? Or should the church say, well, this is a matter of opinion. I mean, some people think that the dollar is God, and therefore they have the choice. They can worship that if they like. Other Christians think that something else is God. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, you have to identify idolatry. If something is being given the place that belongs to God, the church has to identify that. Now, that's difficult to identify exactly. You know, when does the crossover happen that you become a worshiper of the Almighty dollar? That's kind of hard, I admit. But when that point comes, the church has a responsibility of identifying that idolatry. Now, suppose that there were a country that made an idolatry out of security. Suppose that the countries were so preoccupied with security that everything else had to be given, had to give way to the notion of security. Suppose this country were a city-state, and that the whole effort of the city-state was into building a wall around the city-state so nobody could get at it, so it could defend itself. Now, I imagine if it invested all of its efforts into building such a wall, an invulnerable wall, that it might almost be possible to do that. But do you see what would happen in the process? If the city would invest all of its efforts into building the wall, all of the things that would go on to the reason for defending the city would evaporate. People wouldn't be taking care of their families the way they ought to be taking care of them, and on it would go, because this wall would have to be built. Well, then it would be important for a prophet to come, an Amos to come, and to say, look, there are more important things than building walls. In fact, by building this wall and putting so much effort into that, you are actually isolating yourself from your neighbors, not responsive to your neighbors, and you're forcing them to throw bricks over at you with little messages on them in order to get to you. And then you throw a brick back with a little message on it, you know, and that's the only communication left. Your attempt to provide security is actually backfiring. You're cutting yourself off from people who are around you. Do you see how security can be made an idolatry? Now, if the point would come in that city-state where it would be so preoccupied with that security that it would be idolatrous, it would be the function of the church, the congregation in that city-state, to ask the questions and to take an official position saying, we are preoccupied with security. We're putting that above God. There comes a point where we need to call a spade and identify idolatry. It is always a temptation of countries that are among the haves to be preoccupied with security so nobody can take it away from them. And somebody in that country has to identify that temptation. Somebody has the responsibility as a service to the country. Now, there's a second dimension to that, and that is in all countries, ours included, there are powers that are available in the country. And our society was built around having what we call a balance of power, countervailing powers. Because if any power gets too strong and begins to have too heavy a weight, it carries too much a sense of its own importance and throws things out of balance. So we balance the executive powers with the legislative and the judicial powers and on in our country. We have a very carefully developed balance on that. There is, in our country, as in all countries, a tendency toward concentration of power. In our country today, that happens to be a tendency toward a concentration of economic power. And there are books by Domhoff and people like that who spell out the implications of that. But there is also what President Eisenhower identified as a military-industrial complex, or a more recent writer, Gordon Adams, has identified as an iron triangle. There's gotten to be a cycle in the country of people whose interests coalesce. It's a cycle between the military and the corporations that provide the supplies for the military, and even some elements in Congress. Just to give you one example out of that, it is terrifying to know the number of generals who, after they are finished with their work in the military, become vice presidents of corporations that supply arms to the military. Now, I mean, just think that through a little bit. You're a general, you're about to retire, and of course, you know, you're 50 years old, and you've got a lot of energy left, and so on. And here's this corporate General Dynamics, you know, and they could use all your expertise and all that sort of thing. I mean, in those last 5 years before you retire, are you going to alienate General Dynamics? Yeah. I mean, there's real, you understand? There's a real temptation there. They need people who are well informed. And it isn't as though somebody is sitting here and calculating and say, how are we going to do in America or something like that. But it's just the natural kinds of things that all of us would get caught in if we were in that situation. Now, according to the wisdom of our founding fathers, it's important to have a kind of a balance of power. We are developing this concentration of power that is comparable to the industrial complex of the German Ruhr development in the 1930s. And the question in our country is, where are the countervailing forces coming from? Who is going to balance this power? Now, it's because of that, this is probably the center of my argument, it's because of that that I feel that the organized church, one of the powers and responsibilities of the organized church, is to be a countervailing power in our society. This is one body that can speak up and can say, hey, what about that? Is that really the best way to go? Not to say, oh, that's a bad way to go, but to say, is that the best way to go? Is that really the most desirable for the country? Let me give you an example specifically from Star Wars. I'm going to be showing tomorrow over in Koinonia a video that was prepared by the High Frontier people. These were the people who developed the concept of Star Wars and used this video to sell it around in Washington, D.C., and finally in the White House. It's the exact video that was used to describe it. And in the segment that I show right toward the end, one of the arguments that it gives, it says, and think, another reason for doing this is that we've got all this ability, all this space technology around, and we have to find some good use for it. And here we've got a good use for it. You see? I mean, the way the momentum develops for something like that. Now, it all gets kind of built into its own structure. And in the middle of that, some force in society has to be able to stand back and say, look, is that really the best way to go? Let me give you another example from Star Wars. The Strategic Defense Initiative, which is the official name for it, has a policy of giving out contracts in those congressional districts where swing votes are important for the continuation of Star Wars. It's happened in Iowa. The University of Iowa has a policy of not having research work done for Star Wars. That's an official policy of the university. The Strategic Defense Initiative people went through a consortium of people, a consortium of schools of which Iowa was one, and through the physicists and so on that were involved, worked it so that a contract was offered for research in which Iowa was involved in that consortium. Now, as that develops more, and if I were in charge of Strategic Defense Initiative, I'd do the same thing. You know, I mean, I'm not saying those people are evil or something, are plotting to do us in or something. I mean, that's a natural thing. That's a political way of getting the job done, isn't it? But you see what happens as the momentum develops, more and more people get dependent on this sort of thing. Let me show you again a matter of a third example, a matter of priorities. Member of one of our church college faculties, a physicist from one of our church colleges, went to San Diego for an interview with a firm that has a contract for Star Wars. he did his interview, and they felt that he was somebody who could contribute to them. And so they said to him, "Well, what would it take? What kind of salary would it take for you to be interested in moving from your place where you are and coming to this place and working for us here?" Well, he did a little quick pencil scheduling. You know, it costs a little more to live in the San Diego area. You have to move and that sort of thing. Figured out. So he gave him a salary that was 2.5 times the salary that he was getting. 2.5 times the salary he was getting. And they all laughed at him. They said, "Nobody works for money like that here." That's quality decision of priority. And if we decide that our best brains are to go in a certain direction, we better be sure that it's worth it. I mean, that's more important than the money as far as I'm concerned. Where are the best students that I teach? Where are they going to go? Where are they going to find the job? What gets priority in this country of ours? And if we get skewed in a direction that is out of proportion, it could be very dangerous for us all. Who is to interrupt? Who is to raise the question, if not the church? Do we just say, "Well, now we're all going to have a discussion period about this at Holden, and we're going to go to our local churches, we're going to have a discussion, and after we've had that discussion, everybody will scatter out, and everybody will make a decision for himself or herself and get involved in his own political process and let it go with it?" Is that the responsible position of the church? That's the tough question, do you see? Or shall the church say, "This is a point where we need to take a stand"? I've got a couple other points I want to make because I want to say good time for discussion. A second place where I think the church can contribute to this is the matter of global perspective. The church is a worldwide church. The Lutheran church is a worldwide church. One of the great assets that we have is that we are in contact with people all over the globe. A poignant moment for me was on our campus when we had a conversation between a representative from South Africa, member of the embassy from South Africa on our campus, in a conversation with a senator who opposed South African policies. It was a high-level sort of thing. And representative from South Africa was explaining how the apartheid position was a perfectly reasonable way of doing things. He was a very able fellow at interpreting this. And then when it came time for the question period, the president of our college, Bob Vogel, who had been in the office of Preuss's office, he had been an assistant to Preuss, the bishop of the church, stood up because Bishop Preuss had been over at Namibia, which was affected by the policies of South Africa. And he said, "Look, we don't have to take your word for what's happening in South Africa, because we have brothers and sisters over there who tell us what's happening there, really." That's where the church comes alive. We don't have to be subjected to the propagandizing of the powers that be, because the church is alive all over the world. And there's another dimension about the church. Even those people who are not within the church are still people whom God loves and for whom Christ died. It isn't just a matter of looking after church people. It's a matter of looking after all people. One of the things about the church is that it crosses all these boundaries, the boundaries of nationalism. It can help to temper our nationalism. There are some virtues to nationalism. But it can also become demonic, become our ultimate concern and commitment. And the church has a responsibility for calling us to a global perspective. The church crosses boundaries. It crosses iron curtains, even. I have only one regret about being at Holden this summer, and that is because I accepted this responsibility, I could not accept an appointment to go to Prague. Otherwise, if I weren't here, I'd be in Prague this month in a conversation between the churches of the East and the West about how can we bring peace. Now, that happened in Prague this month. Because we are a world church that crosses those boundaries. And we can talk together as Christians about this. We can talk with Russian Christians and Hungarian Christians and Czechoslovakian Christians and Polish and East German Christians, Western and Eastern Christians, earnestly pursuing how we will find a way toward peace. Now the church brings that kind of perspective. And we can have an official position that develops out of that, it seems to me, on issues that are very important. One of the things that this kind of crossover makes possible is that we can really understand the people who are called our enemies. Now, on the one hand, it's my feeling that sometimes people who are opposed to the nuclear arms race and all that sort of thing tend to dismiss the seriousness of the situation. There are real struggles that are involved. There is real competition in the world for the hearts and minds of people. I don't have any illusions about that. So we can look at the seriousness of the situation. We're free to look at the seriousness of the situation. But also, we are free so that we're not intimidated and don't exaggerate the enemy. It's so easy to make the enemy larger than life and be just terrified before this big enemy out there, you know. I mean, remember David when he went out to face Goliath. Saul gave him his armor and he put the armor on and he started out of the tent and he started clanging along, you know. And he said, oh, this was never going to work. No matter how big Goliath looked, you know, it was still those five smooth stones, to use the image, that David needed. Well, it is tempting to make the enemy larger than life. So let's speak specifically about the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is an ambitious power. It believes that it has the answers to the world's problems. And it would like to extend its influence to other people. I don't think we should have any illusions about that. The United States thinks it has the answer to the world's problems. That's how we could go on and on. And we seek to increase our sphere of influence. What happens when those collide? See, that's the question. Now, we can't exaggerate what is at stake. I think we should look full in the face the things, the realities that are there. But to exaggerate them way out of proportion, to make some kind of monster out of the enemy, do you see how that contributes to the escalation? I see that enemy is larger than life, so I get puffed myself up, and then the enemy sees me as being more puffed up, so the enemy has to respond. So you get into a cycle like that, which gets to be mutually destructive. Now somebody has to stop that cycle. And who better than Christians who see that the world is God's world and that God loves communists as much as he loves capitalists? Then we can see, well, it is indeed a competitive world and we are each out struggling to gain our sphere of influence, but we see it in proportion a little bit better. And we don't exaggerate it. And we begin to see, now let's see, there are some mutual concerns that we have. Both of us are escalating our expenditures for the nuclear arms race way out of proportion. Do you know, for example, that the Soviet Union has half of the economic base, the GNP, that the U.S. has? You know what that means? That for them to stay in the arms race, they have to take twice as high a proportion of their expenditures as we do. There's no question they're willing to do that. I mean, but do you see the pressure they have? Would it not be in their interest even more than ours to unwind the arms race? Not because they're good guys, and not because, you know, they say, oh, yeah, that'd be a nice thing to do. But because it would be to the well-being of their country as well as ours. Now, those are the things we have to look at. Now, Christians have the possibility, the church has the possibility of inviting people to see those aspects of the arms race. I was
in conversation with a Lutheran who was involved in the START talks. We happened to be in Geneva at the same time, and he happened to be more militant in his approach to that and so on than I was. But both of us agreed that this was a point at which negotiations could be handled in a very serious way, a perspective that was very important. And he assured me that that point was being made known to President Reagan. He, in fact, was a national security advisor to President Reagan. Well, the third point I've got here, I'll just state. It's a very important one, but it's also important to have conversation. The third role the church has is to hold out hope. It is really tempting for us in this day and age to become demoralized and to have a sense of resignation about it all. I want Alan to say a word about this, but just let me tell you a story. A little 6-year-old came to his grandpa, and his grandpa was his birthday. He was 60 years old, sat on grandpa's lap, and the little boy says, "Oh, happy birthday, grandpa. I'm glad you're 60 years old." Well, grandpa wasn't too sure he was glad he was 60. But the little boy then said, "I wish I could get to be 60 someday." Well, Grandpa says, "Of course you'll get to be 60. You know, you eat your vegetables, you follow the Holden diet and all that sort of thing, and you'll get to be 60 someday." And the little boy says, "Oh, no, I won't." He says, "Why not?" "Well, Grandpa, the bomb is going to get me first." Now, that's an aura in which we, our children, grow up. It's a price that we're already paying for the nuclear arms race. There is a temptation to resignation generally, that we can't do anything about it. Let me just say to you that one of the things Christians have is Easter, resurrection, hope. In the darkest of times, there is hope. And even while the arms race is being escalated, it is the Christian community that can speak a word and can say, "It does not have to be this way." That holds out a hope. Let me just say that resignation is really dehumanizing. And let me just say that in my experience with this over the last few years when I've been involved with this issue, I must say that even in our American system, this is going outside now of the Christian perspective, but even from the point of view of our American system, I have found hope, and a lot of people haven't seen that, so let me say two words about that before we go to discussion. A few years ago, I was in Rapid City, South Dakota at a conference, and one of the other presenters there was Edwin Firmage. He was on the Arms Control Commission and was a representative of the United States from Utah. He told the story about the MX deployment in Utah. Remember when the MX was first conceived, it was to be put on these racetracks around in Utah. He said when that proposal was made, and this was under the Carter administration, and so it's not a matter of sort of politics one way or the other. When that was first proposed, everybody in Utah was enthusiastic about it. 3-1, people favored that deployment of the MX because there'd be all kinds of jobs to Utah. There'd be kind of construction that would be around, and it would be just a great boon for Utah. My son was working in the oil fields in Wyoming, and the people who were working on that construction there in the oil field in Wyoming, they couldn't wait for the MX to open up in Utah because they knew that's where the big money was going to be next, you know. So that was the, kind of the mood. But Edwin Firmage, who had been involved in nuclear arms negotiations, paused about this. And he began to talk, first of all, with church people. Protestants, he brought together representative Protestants and Catholics, a very small group, started with that. Began to talk around to church groups, then started talking to environmental groups, then started talking with the sheep herders and the cattlemen because it was going to gobble up a lot of their land, you know, and that sort of thing. Went talking around in the schoolhouses and so on. And after a while, the temper of Utah began to shift. Pretty soon, it was about 50-50. And before long, it was 3-1 opposed to the MX missile. Part of it, I think, was because of a marvelous slogan they hit upon. You know that it was in Nevada that they had those tests that were made earlier, and then the fallout from those tests killed those sheep, and then there was a cancer that was caused and so on that floated out across Utah and so on. So based on that nuclear test that had happened earlier, they said they had this slogan: first guinea pigs, now sitting ducks. You see the point they were making? The Amex is in Utah. Guess who's going to get it first? Well, it swung so much that even the Mormon Church made its first political statement officially and came out opposed to the Amex missile. Senator Laxalt got the message from Utah. He had the ear of President Reagan at that time, and he talked to President Reagan and told him the feelings of the people about this, and the U.S. government is responsive to the people. The Amex is not located in Utah. It started because people in the church voiced their concern. A hope. They didn't resign themselves to a cycle of inevitability. They said it doesn't have to be this way. Well, another example here, but I'll just break off from this because we need to take some time for some discussion. Alan, I'd like it. Alan is a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's been at a conference in Hungary on this issue just back from, what, 6 weeks ago or so that it was held. And if you could just take a couple of minutes to talk about the costs of the arms race, that would kind of tie in with what I said, please.
Mm-hmm. I attended a conference that was actually early July in Hungary. Over 1,000 MDs, nurses, and health workers attended from 40 countries. And I'll give you a little aside. Why I believe Star Wars is an immoral thing. It's basically probably the final escalation of the arms race. And it is, in addition to what I'm going to say, in terms of what this is costing the world, in terms of human and natural resources. And this doesn't include any Star Wars costs at all. This speech was given by the president of the American Public Health Association, and I'll read a couple of paragraphs. During 1985, the world will spend $800 billion on arms. This sum, incredibly, is equivalent to the total gross national product of all the countries in which the poorest one-half of the world's population live. This one-year expenditure is equivalent to the entire debt that the poor nations of the world owe the rich nations, the debt whose repayment problems are said to threaten the world's banking system. The world's current rate of expenditure on arms is approximately $2 billion per day, $100 million each hour, $1.5 million each minute. The situation of many of the poor people of the world that uses its precious resources to produce instruments of death is desperate. More than 40,000 children die every day from malnutrition and infection. Over 300 million children in the developing countries are chronically hungry. 2 billion of the world's people do not have access to a dependable and sanitary supply of water. In some countries, fewer than 5% of the population have access to safe water. Water-related diseases kill 10 million people every year. And I'll read a short summary of how the costs of the arms race relate to cost of health care. Redirection of even relatively small amounts of the resources devoted to worldwide arms race could make an enormous difference in world health. The cost of 3 hours of the world arms spending could pay for all of the World Health Organization's $250 million annual budget. The cost of 3 hours of the world arms spending could more than cover the $300 million spent by World Health Organization in the successful effort to eradicate smallpox from the earth, or the annual cost of a proposed World Health Program to immunize 100 million newborns each year in the developing countries against childhood diseases. The cost of 4 days of the world's arms spending could pay for a $7.5 billion five-year malaria control program dealing with the world's greatest cause of morbidity. The cost of 6 months of the world's arms spending could pay for a 20-year program providing essential food and health needs in the entire world. One of the best summaries of social cost of military expenditures came from President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Quote, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children." End quote.
Thank you.
specific issue of the virtue of Star Wars we'll be discussing tomorrow, about whether it's defensive or whether it constitutes an escalation of the system. What I wanted to raise today was simply whether it's something the church should be talking about. And I invite your response, please.
I think I'd like to comment on the leader point that you used.
Yeah.
In the Utah situation, a large reason for the withdrawal from there was that the technical capability to do what they were proposing to do just is not a viable concept.
Really?
And that it was withdrawn largely for that reason, more than any other reason, as far as politicians are
concerned. I had heard the matter of cost as another one besides one because it would have been a huge construction cost.
Mm-hmm. Star Wars has not been deterred by cost. It became a question of technical viability and it simply could not be done. If it was a vulnerable citizen using the concept that was being proposed for Utah.
That's very interesting.
And then that's very
interesting. Yeah. I don't go to many movies. Have the past 20 years. What are you talking about? What is Star Wars? Is that something, a movie or something?
Can I give you a little summary from Newsweek? It tells you exactly what Star Wars is. See, the problem with mounting a nuclear defense, which is what Star Wars is, a defensive system.
It's a what?
A defensive system.
Oh, yeah.
Defense in opposition to offense. No, right now we have an offensive deterrent. What we have are missiles aimed at each other, which if one button is pushed, the other is pushed, and it's called mutually assured destruction, MAD. And that's an accepted term, mutual assured destruction. That's our system right now. It's an offensive system. Now let me read what Star Wars is. It's a defender's problem. The problem with mounting a nuclear defense is the offense has a 40-year head start, which may prove insurmountable. A Soviet attack on the U.S. would begin with the launching of more than 2,000 land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles simultaneously. Any defense would have to go to work literally within seconds to destroy as many missiles as possible in the boost phase, which is while the rocket engines are firing, which lasts only about 5 minutes. Following the boost phase, each missile releases as many as 10 separate warheads, each on a different trajectory, so the defense now must face as many as 20,000 targets. To complicate the defender's problem, the missiles may also carry hundreds of thousands of decoy warheads that would have to be tracked. This mid-course phase lasts 20 minutes or so, after which the warheads re-enter the atmosphere on their way toward their target. At this point, the lighter decoy warheads would be stripped away, making the defense job easier again. But by then, the warheads are only 1 minute from impact, and a nuclear bomb going off even at considerable altitude can wreak havoc on what weapons designers refer to as soft target, meaning people. For most of their course, the missiles would be over the horizon from ground stations in the U.S., so the defensive weaponry would have to be situated on hundreds of satellites. There, even if such a trenchant problem as space lift and computing and power supply could be solved, they would be open to preemptive strike by Soviet anti-satellite weapons. So the whole Star Wars is put weapons up in space to intercept those weapons coming from the enemy. That's what Star Wars is. Mm-hmm.
All right, there's another hand over here.
Yeah? Given that technology is growing exponentially, that's a given for the past and has been growing exponentially. Given that the Russians wish to grow economic growth by ever expanding and growing, seems to me that it's necessary.
The question is whether, I'll repeat this so everybody hears. The question is that since technology is growing and since the Soviets are an ambitious people, we can't just let ourselves or let them get ahead and just sit back and do nothing. That's basically the question. Mm-hmm. I do want to get into that a little bit more tomorrow, the technical aspects of it, and we can talk about that. Let me just, so I'm not avoiding the question, say to you that the issue about the Strategic Defense Initiative is not whether there should be any research on this or not.
We are already spending $1 billion a year on strategic defense initiative programs. The question is whether we shall multiply the amount that we are doing on that, whether we will unilaterally take the initiative and spend five times that much per year at going ahead on that. That's the issue that's at stake, just to clarify that.